Consider, for example, how universities are divided into different faculties and departments. History is separate from biology and from mathematics. Why? Certainly, this division doesn't reflect objective reality. It is the intersubjective invention of academic bureaucrats. The COVID-19 pandemic, for example, was at one and the same time a historical, biological, and mathematical event. But the academic study of pandemics is divided between the separate departments of history, biology, and mathematics, among others. Students pursuing an academic degree must usually decide to which of these departments they belong. Their decision limits their choice of courses, which in turn shapes their understanding of the world. Mathematics students learn how to predict future morbidity levels from present rates of infection. Biology students learn how viruses mutate over time. And history students learn how religious and political beliefs affect people's willingness to follow government instructions. To fully understand COVID-19 requires taking into account mathematical, biological, and historical phenomena. But academic bureaucracy doesn't encourage such a holistic approach. As you climb the academic ladder, the pressure to specialize only increases. The academic world is ruled by the law of publish or perish. If you want a job, you must publish in peer-reviewed journals. But journals are divided by discipline. And publishing an article on virus mutations in a biology journal demands following different conventions from publishing an article on the politics of pandemics in a history journal. There are different jargons, different citation rules, and different expectations. Historians should have a deep understanding of culture and know how to read and interpret historical documents. Biologists should have a deep understanding of evolution and know how to read and interpret DNA molecules. Things that fall in between categories, like the interplay between human political ideologies and virus evolution, are often left unaddressed. To appreciate how academics force a messy and fluid world into rigid bureaucratic categories, let's dig a little deeper in the specific discipline of biology. Before Darwin could explain the origin of species, earlier scholars like Carl Linnaeus first had to define what a species is and classify all living organisms into species. To argue that lions and tigers evolved from a common feline ancestor, you first have to define lions and tigers. This turned out to be a difficult and never-ending job, because animals, plants, and other organisms often trespass the boundaries of their allotted drawers. Evolution cannot be easily contained in any bureaucratic schema. The whole point of evolution is that species continually change, which means that putting each species in one unchanging drawer distorts biological reality. For example, it is an open question when Homo erectus ended and Homo sapiens began. Were there once two erectus parents whose child was the first sapiens? Species also keep intermingling, with animals belonging to seemingly separate species not only having sex, but even siring fertile offspring. Most sapiens living today have about 1-3% Neanderthal DNA, indicating that there once was a child whose father was a Neanderthal and whose mother was a sapiens, or vice versa. So, are sapiens and Neanderthals the same species or different species? And is species an objective reality that biologists discover, or is it an intersubjective reality that biologists impose? There are numerous other examples of animals breaking out of their drawers, so the neat bureaucratic division fails to accurately categorize ring species, fusion species, and hybrids. Grizzly bears and polar bears sometimes produce pizzly bears and grolar bears. Lions and tigers produce ligers and tigons. When we shift our attention from mammals and other multicellular organisms to the world of single-cell bacteria and archaea, we discover that anarchy reigns. In the process known as horizontal gene transfer, single-cell organisms routinely exchange genetic material not only with organisms from related species, but also with organisms from entirely different genera, kingdoms, orders, and even domains. Bacteriologists have a very difficult job keeping tabs on these chimeras. And when we reach the very edge of life and consider viruses like SARS-CoV-2, responsible for COVID-19, things become even more complicated. Viruses straddle the supposed rigid boundary between living beings and lifeless matter, between biology and chemistry. Unlike bacteria, viruses aren't single-cell organisms. They aren't cells at all, and don't possess any cellular machinery of their own. Viruses don't eat or metabolize, and cannot reproduce by themselves. They are tiny packets of genetic code, which are able to penetrate cells, hijack their cellular machinery, and instruct them to produce more copies of that alien genetic code. The new copies burst out of the cell to infect and hijack more cells, which is how the alien code turns viral. Scientists argue endlessly about whether viruses should count as life forms or whether they fall outside the boundary of life. But this boundary isn't an objective reality. It is an intersubjective convention. Even if biologists reach a consensus that viruses are life forms, it wouldn't change anything about how viruses behave. It will only change how humans think about them. Of course, intersubjective conventions are themselves part of reality. As we humans become more powerful, so our intersubjective beliefs become more consequential for the world outside our information networks. For example, scientists and legislators have categorized species according to the threat of extinction they face on a scale ranging from least concern through vulnerable and endangered to extinct. Defining a particular population of animals as an endangered species is an intersubjective human convention, but it can have far-reaching consequences. For instance, by imposing legal restrictions on hunting those animals or destroying their habitat. A bureaucratic decision about whether a certain animal belongs in the endangered species drawer or in the vulnerable species drawer could make the difference between life and death. As we shall see time and again in subsequent chapters, when a bureaucracy puts a label on you, even though the label might be pure convention, it can still determine your fate. That's true whether the bureaucrat is a flesh-and-blood expert on animals, a flesh-and-blood expert on humans, or an inorganic AI. The deep state. In defense of bureaucracy, it should be noted that while it sometimes sacrifices truth and distorts our understanding of the world, it often does so for the sake of order, without which it would be hard to maintain any large-scale human network. While bureaucracies are never perfect, is there a better way to manage big networks? For example, if we decided to abolish all conventional divisions in the academic world, all departments and faculties and specialized journals, would every prospective doctor be expected to devote several years to the study of history? And would people who studied the impact of the Black Death on Christian theology be considered expert virologists? Would it lead to better healthcare systems? Anyone who fantasizes about abolishing all bureaucracies in favor of a more holistic approach to the world should reflect on the fact that hospitals, too, are bureaucratic institutions. They are divided into different departments with hierarchies, protocols, and lots of forms to fill out. They suffer from many bureaucratic illnesses, but they still manage to cure us of many of our biological illnesses. The same goes for almost all the other services that make our life better, from our schools to our sewage system. When you flush the toilet, where does the waste go? It goes into the deep state. There is an intricate subterranean web of pipes, pumps, and tunnels that runs under our houses and collects our waste, separates it from the supply of drinking water, and either treats or safely disposes of it. Somebody needs to design, construct, and maintain that deep web, plug holes in it, monitor pollution levels, and pay the workers. That too is bureaucratic work, and we would face a lot of discomfort and even death if we abolished that particular department. Sewage water and drinking water are always in danger of mixing, but luckily for us, there are bureaucrats who keep them separate. Prior to the establishment of modern sewage systems, waterborne infectious diseases like dysentery and cholera killed millions of people around the world. In 1854, hundreds of London residents began dying of cholera. It was a relatively small outbreak, but it proved to be a turning point in the history of cholera, of epidemics more generally, and of sewage. The leading medical theory of the day argued that cholera epidemics were caused by bad air. But the physician John Snow suspected that the cause was the water supply. He painstakingly tracked and listed all known cholera patients, their place of residence, and their source of water. The resulting data led him to identify the water pump on Broad Street in Soho as the epicenter of the outbreak. This was tedious bureaucratic work, collecting data, categorizing it, and mapping it, but it saved lives. Snow explained his findings to local officials, persuading them to disable the Broad Street pump, which effectively ended the outbreak. Subsequent research discovered that the well providing water to the Broad Street pump was dug less than a meter from a cholera-infected cesspit. Snow's discovery, and the work of many subsequent scientists, engineers, lawyers, and officials, resulted in a sprawling bureaucracy regulating cesspits, water pumps, and sewage lines. In today's England, digging wells and constructing cesspits require filling out forms and getting licenses, which ensure that drinking water doesn't come from a well someone dug next to a cesspit. It is easy to forget about this system when it works well, but since 1854 it has saved millions of lives, and it is one of the most important services provided by modern states. In 2014, Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India identified the lack of toilets as one of India's biggest problems. Open defecation is a major cause for spreading diseases like cholera, dysentery, and diarrhea, as well as exposing women and girls to sexual assaults. As part of his flagship Clean India mission, Modi promised to provide all Indian citizens with access to toilets, and between 2014 and 2020, the Indian state invested around $10 billion in the project, building more than 100 million new latrines. Sewage isn't the stuff of epic poems, but it is a test of a well-functioning state. The biological dramas. Mythology and bureaucracy are the twin pillars of every large-scale society. Yet while mythology tends to inspire fascination, bureaucracy tends to inspire suspicion. Despite the services they provide, even beneficial bureaucracies often fail to win the public's trust. For many people, the very word bureaucracy carries negative connotations. This is because it is inherently difficult to know whether a bureaucratic system is beneficial or malicious. For all bureaucracies, good or bad, share one key characteristic. It is hard for humans to understand them. Any kid can tell the difference between a friend and a bully. You know if someone shares their lunch with you or instead takes yours. But when the tax collector comes to take a cut from your earnings, how can you tell whether it goes to build a new public sewage system or a new private dacha for the president? It is hard to get all the relevant information and even harder to interpret it. It is similarly difficult for citizens to understand the bureaucratic procedures determining how pupils are admitted to schools, how patients are treated in hospitals, or how garbage is collected and recycled. It takes a minute to tweet allegations of bias, fraud, or corruption, and many weeks of arduous work to prove or disprove them. Documents, archives, forms, licenses, regulations, and other bureaucratic procedures have changed the way information flows in society, and with it, the way power works. This made it far more difficult to understand power. What is happening behind the closed doors of offices and archives, where anonymous officials analyze and organize piles of documents and determine our fate with a stroke of a pen or a click of a mouse? In tribal societies that lack written documents and bureaucracies, the human network is composed of only human-to-human and human-to-story chains. Authority belongs to the people who control the junctions that link the various chains. These junctions are the tribe's foundational myths. Charismatic leaders, orators, and mythmakers know how to use these stories in order to shape identities, build alliances, and sway emotions. In human networks connected by written documents and bureaucratic procedures, from ancient Ur to modern India, society relies in part on the interaction between humans and documents. In addition to human-to-human and human-to-story chains, such societies are held together by human-to-document chains. When we observe a bureaucratic society at work, we still see humans telling stories to other humans, as when millions of Indians watch the Ramayana series. But we also see humans passing documents to other humans, as when TV networks are required to apply for broadcasting licenses and fill out tax reports. Looked at from a different perspective, what we see is documents compelling humans to engage with other documents. This led to shifts in authority. As documents became a crucial nexus linking many social chains, considerable power came to be invested in these documents, and experts in the arcane logic of documents emerged as new authority figures. Administrators, accountants, and lawyers mastered not just reading and writing, but also the skills of composing forms, separating drawers, and managing archives. In bureaucratic systems, power often comes from understanding how to manipulate obscure budgetary loopholes and from knowing your way around the labyrinths of offices, committees, and subcommittees. This shift in authority changed the balance of power in the world. For better or worse, literate bureaucracies tended to strengthen the central authority at the expense of ordinary citizens. It's not just that documents and archives made it easier for the center to tax, judge, and conscript everybody. The difficulty of understanding bureaucratic power simultaneously made it harder for the masses to influence, resist, or evade the central authority. Even when bureaucracy was a benign force, providing people with sewage systems, education, and security, it still tended to increase the gap between rulers and ruled. The system enabled the center to collect and record a lot more information about the people it governed, while the latter found it much more difficult to understand how the system itself worked. Art, which helps us understand many other aspects of life, offered only limited assistance in this case. Poets, playwrights, and movie makers have occasionally focused on the dynamics of bureaucratic power. However, this has proven to be a very difficult story to communicate. Artists usually work with a limited set of storylines that are rooted in our biology, but none of these biological dramas sheds much light on the workings of bureaucracy, because they have all been scripted by evolution millions of years before the emergence of documents and archives. To understand what biological dramas are and why they are a poor guide for understanding bureaucracy, let's consider in detail the plot of one of humanity's greatest artistic masterpieces, the Ramayana. One important plotline in the Ramayana concerns the relations between the eponymous prince Rama, his father, King Dasharatha, and his stepmother, Queen Kaikeyi. Though Rama, being the eldest son, is the rightful heir to the kingdom, Kaikeyi persuades the king to banish Rama to the wilderness and bestow the succession instead on her son Bharata. Underlying this plotline are several biological dramas that go back hundreds of millions of years in mammalian and avian evolution. All mammal and bird offspring depend on their parents in the first stage of life, seek parental care, and fear parental neglect or hostility. Life and death hang in the balance. A cub or chick pushed out of the nest too soon is in danger of death from starvation or predation. Among humans, the fear of being neglected or abandoned by one's parents is a template not just for children's stories like Snow White, Cinderella, and Harry Potter, but also for some of our most influential national and religious myths. The Ramayana is far from being the sole example. In Christian theology, damnation is conceived as losing all contact with the Mother Church and the Heavenly Father. Hell is a lost child crying for his or her missing parents. A related biological drama, which is also familiar to human children, mammalian cubs, and avian chicks, is "Father loves me more than he loves you." Biologists and geneticists have identified sibling rivalry as one of the key processes of evolution. Siblings routinely compete for food and parental attention, and in some species, the killing of one sibling by another is commonplace. About a quarter of spotted hyena cubs are killed by their siblings, who typically enjoy greater parental care as a result. Among sand tiger sharks, females hold numerous embryos in their uterus. The first embryo that reaches about 10 centimeters in length then eats all the others. The dynamics of sibling rivalry are manifested in numerous myths in addition to the Ramayana. For instance, in the stories of Cain and Abel, King Lear, and the TV series Succession. Entire nations, like the Jewish people, may base their identity on the claim that we are Father's favorite children. The second major plotline of the Ramayana focuses on the romantic triangle formed by Prince Rama, his lover Sita, and the demon king Ravana, who kidnaps Sita. Boy meets girl and boy fights boy over girl are also biological dramas that have been enacted by countless mammals, birds, reptiles, and fish for hundreds of millions of years. We are mesmerized by these stories because understanding them has been essential for our ancestors' survival. Human storytellers, like Homer, Shakespeare, and Valmiki, the purported author of the Ramayana, have displayed an amazing capacity to elaborate on the biological dramas. But even the greatest poetical narratives usually copy their basic plotline from the Handbook of Evolution. A third theme recurring in the Ramayana is the tension between purity and impurity, with Sita being the paragon of purity in Hindu culture. The cultural obsession with purity originates in the evolutionary struggle to avoid pollution. All animals are torn between the need to try new food and the fear of being poisoned. Evolution, therefore, equipped animals with both curiosity and the capacity to feel disgust on coming into contact with something toxic or otherwise dangerous. Politicians and prophets have learned how to manipulate these disgust mechanisms. In nationalist and religious myths, countries or churches are depicted as a biological body in danger of being polluted by impure intruders. For centuries, bigots have often said that ethnic and religious minorities spread diseases, that LGBTQ people are a source of pollution, or that women are impure. During the Rwanda genocide of 1994, Hutu propaganda referred to the Tutsis as cockroaches. The Nazis compared Jews to rats. Experiments have shown that chimpanzees, too, react with disgust to images of unfamiliar chimpanzees from another band. Perhaps in no other culture was the biological drama of purity versus impurity carried to greater extremes than in traditional Hinduism. It constructed an intersubjective system of castes ranked by their supposed level of purity, with the pure Brahmins at the top and the allegedly impure Dalit, formerly known as untouchables, at the bottom. Professions, tools, and everyday activities have also been classified by their level of purity, and strict rules have forbidden impure persons to marry pure people, touch them, prepare food for them, or even come near them. The modern state of India still struggles with this legacy, which influences almost all aspects of life. For example, fears of impurity created various complications for the aforementioned Clean India mission, because allegedly pure people were reluctant to get involved in impure activities such as building, maintaining, and cleaning toilets, or to share public latrines with allegedly impure persons. On September 25, 2019, two Dalit children, 12-year-old Roshni Valmiki and her 10-year-old nephew, Avinash, were lynched in the Indian village of Bhagadi for defecating near the house of a family from the higher Yadav caste. They were forced to defecate in public because their houses lacked functioning toilets. A local official later explained that their household, while being among the poorest in the village, was nevertheless excluded from the list of families eligible for government aid to build toilets. The children routinely suffered from other caste-based discrimination, for example, being forced to bring separate mats and utensils to school and to sit apart from the other pupils so as not to pollute them. The list of biological dramas that press our emotional buttons includes several additional classics, such as Who Will Be Alpha, Us Versus Them, and Good Versus Evil. These dramas, too, feature prominently in the Ramayana, and all of them are well known to wolf packs and chimpanzee bands, as well as to human societies. Together, these biological dramas form the backbone of almost all human art and mythology. But art's dependence on the biological dramas has made it difficult for artists to explain the mechanisms of bureaucracy. The Ramayana is set within the context of large agrarian kingdoms, but it shows little interest in how such kingdoms register property, collect taxes, catalogue archives, or finance wars. Sibling rivalry and romantic triangles aren't a good guide for the dynamics of documents, which have no siblings and no romantic life. Storytellers like Franz Kafka, who focused on the often surreal ways that bureaucracy shapes human lives, pioneered new non-biological plot lines. In Kafka's The Trial, the bank clerk K is arrested by unidentified officials of an unfathomable agency for an unnamed crime. Despite his best efforts, he never understands what is happening to him or uncovers the aims of the agency that is crushing him. While sometimes taken as an existential or theological reference to the human condition in the universe and to the unfathomability of God, on a more mundane level, the story highlights the potentially nightmarish character of bureaucracies, which, as an insurance lawyer, Kafka knew all too well. In bureaucratic societies, the lives of ordinary people are often upended by unidentified officials of an unfathomable agency for incomprehensible reasons. Whereas stories about heroes who confront monsters, from the Ramayana to Spider-Man, repackage the biological dramas of confronting predators and romantic rivals, the unique horror of Kafkaesque stories comes from the unfathomability of the threat. Evolution has primed our minds to understand death by a tiger. Our mind finds it much more difficult to understand death by a document. Some portrayals of bureaucracy are satirical. Joseph Heller's iconic 1961 novel, Catch-22, used satire to illustrate the central role bureaucracy plays in war. One of the most powerful figures in the novel is ex-private First Class Wintergreen, who, from his power base in the mailroom, decides which letters to forward and which to disappear. The 1980s British sitcoms Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister showed the ways that civil servants use arcane regulations, obscure subcommittees, and piles of documents to manipulate their political bosses. The 2015 comedy drama The Big Short explored the bureaucratic roots of the 2007-08 financial crisis. The movie's arch-villains are not humans, but collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, which are financial devices invented by investment bankers and understood by nobody else in the world. These bureaucratic Godzillas slumbered unnoticed in the depths of bank portfolios until they suddenly emerged in 2007 to wreak havoc on the lives of billions of people by instigating a major financial crisis. Artworks like these have had some success in shaping perceptions of how bureaucratic power works, but this is an uphill battle, because since the Stone Age, our minds have been primed to focus on biological dramas rather than bureaucratic ones. Most Hollywood and Bollywood blockbusters are not about CDOs. Rather, even in the 21st century, most blockbusters are essentially Stone Age stories about the hero who fights the monster to win the girl. Similarly, when depicting the dynamics of political power, TV series like Game of Thrones, The Crown, and Succession focus on the family intrigues of the dynastic court rather than on the bureaucratic labyrinth that sustains, and sometimes curbs, the dynasty's power. Let's kill all the lawyers. The difficulty of depicting and understanding bureaucratic realities has had unfortunate results. On the one hand, it leaves people feeling helpless in the face of harmful powers they do not understand, like the hero of The Trial. On the other hand, it also leaves people with the impression that bureaucracy is a malign conspiracy, even in cases when it is in fact a benign force providing us with healthcare, security, and justice. In the 16th century, Ludovico Ariosto described the allegorical figure of discord as a woman who walks around in a cloud of sheaves of summonses and writs, cross-examinations and powers of attorney, and great piles of glosses, counsels, opinions, and precedents, all of which tended to the greater insecurity of impoverished folk. In front and behind her and on either side, she was hemmed in by notaries, attorneys, and barristers. In his description of Jack Cade's Rebellion, 1450, in Henry VI, Part 2, Shakespeare has a commoner rebel called Dick the Butcher take the antipathy to bureaucracy to its logical conclusion. Dick has a plan to establish a better social order. "The first thing we do," advises Dick, "let's kill all the lawyers." The rebel leader, Jack Cade, runs with Dick's proposal in a forceful attack on bureaucracy, and in particular on written documents. "Is not this a lamentable thing? That of the skin of an innocent lamb should be made parchment? That parchment, being scribbled o'er, should undo a man? Some say the bee stings, but I say, 'tis the bee's wax. For I did but seal once to a thing, and I was never mine own man since." Just then the rebels capture a clerk and accuse him of being able to write and read. After a short interrogation that establishes his crime, Cade orders his men, "hang him with his pen and inkhorn about his neck." 70 years prior to Jack Cade's rebellion, during the even bigger 1381 Peasants' Revolt, the rebels focused their ire not only on flesh and blood bureaucrats, but also on their documents, destroying numerous archives and burning court rolls, charters, and administrative and legal records. In one incident, they made a bonfire of the archives of the University of Cambridge. An old woman named Marjorie Starr scattered the ashes to the winds while crying, "Away with the learning of the clerks! Away with it!" Thomas Walsingham, a monk in St. Albans Abbey who witnessed the destruction of the abbey's archive firsthand, described how the rebels set fire to all court rolls and muniments, so that after they had got rid of these records of their ancient service, their lords would not be able to claim any right at all against them at some future time. Killing the documents erased the debts. Similar attacks on archives characterized numerous other insurgencies throughout history. For example, during the Great Jewish Revolt in 66 CE, one of the first things the rebels did upon capturing Jerusalem was to set fire to the central archive in order to destroy records of debts, thereby winning the support of the populace. During the French Revolution in 1789, numerous local and regional archives were destroyed for comparable reasons. Many rebels might have been illiterate, but they knew that without the documents, the bureaucratic machine couldn't function. I can sympathize with the suspicion of government bureaucracies and of the power of official documents, because they have played an important role in my own family. My maternal grandfather had his life upended by a government census and by the inability to find a crucial document. My grandfather, Bruno Luttinger, was born in 1913 in Chernivtsi. Today this town is in Ukraine, but in 1913 it was part of the Habsburg Empire. Bruno's father disappeared in World War I, and he was raised by his mother, Chaya Pearl. When the war was over, Chernivtsi was annexed to Romania. In the late 1930s, as Romania became a fascist dictatorship, an important plank of its new anti-Semitic policy was to conduct a Jewish census. In 1936, official statistics said that 758,000 Jews lived in Romania, constituting 4.2% of the population. The same official statistics said that the total number of refugees from the USSR, Jews and non-Jews, was about 11,000. In 1937, a new fascist government came to power, headed by Prime Minister Octavian Goga. Goga was a renowned poet as well as a politician, but he quickly graduated from patriotic poetry to fake statistics and oppressive bureaucracy. He and his colleagues ignored the official statistics and claimed that hundreds of thousands of Jewish refugees were flooding into Romania. In several interviews, Goga claimed that 500,000 Jews had entered Romania illegally and that the total number of Jews in the country was 1.5 million. Government organs, far-right statisticians, and popular newspapers regularly cited even higher figures. The Romanian embassy in Paris, for example, claimed there were 1 million Jewish refugees in Romania. Christian Romanians were gripped by mass hysteria that they would soon be replaced or become a minority in a Jewish-led country. Goga's government stepped in to offer a solution to the imaginary problem invented by its own propaganda. On January 22, 1938, the government issued a law ordering all Jews in Romania to provide documented proof that they were born in Romanian territory and were entitled to Romanian citizenship. Jews who failed to provide proof would lose their citizenship, along with all rights to residence and employment. Suddenly, Romania's Jews found themselves in a bureaucratic hell. Many had to travel to their birthplace to look for the relevant documents, only to discover that the municipal archives were destroyed during World War I. Jews born in territories annexed to Romania only after 1918, like Chernivtsi, faced special difficulties because they lacked Romanian birth certificates and because many other documents about their families were archived in the former Habsburg capitals of Vienna and Budapest instead of in Bucharest. Jews often didn't even know which documents they were supposed to be looking for because the census law didn't specify which documents were considered sufficient proof. Clerks and archivists gained a new and lucrative source of income as frantic Jews offered to pay large bribes to get their hands on the right document. Even if no bribes were involved, the process was extremely costly. Any request for documentation, as well as filing the citizenship request with the authorities, involved paying fees. Finding and filing the right document did not guarantee success. A difference of a single letter between how a name was spelled on the birth certificate and on the citizenship papers was enough for the authorities to revoke the citizenship. Many Jews could not clear these bureaucratic hurdles and didn't even file a citizenship request. Of those who did, only 63% got their citizenship approved. Altogether, out of 758,000 Romanian Jews, 367,000 lost their citizenship. My grandfather, Bruno, was among them. When the new census law was passed in Bucharest, Bruno did not think much about it. He was born in Chernivtsi and had lived there all his life. The thought that he needed to prove to some bureaucrat that he was not an alien struck him as ridiculous. Moreover, in early 1938, his mother fell ill and died, and Bruno felt he had much bigger things to worry about than chasing documents. In December 1938, an official letter arrived from Bucharest cancelling Bruno's citizenship, and as an alien, he was promptly fired from his job in a Chernivtsi radio shop. Bruno was now not only alone and jobless, but also stateless and without much prospect for alternative employment. 9 months later, World War II erupted, and the danger for paperless Jews was mounting. Of the Romanian Jews who lost their citizenship in 1938, the vast majority would be murdered over the next few years by the Romanian fascists and their Nazi allies. Jews who retained their citizenship had a much higher survival rate. My grandfather repeatedly tried to escape the tightening noose, but it was difficult without the right papers. Several times he smuggled himself onto trains and ships, only to be caught and arrested. In 1940, he finally managed to board one of the last ships bound for Palestine before the gates of hell slammed shut. When he arrived in Palestine, he was immediately imprisoned by the British as an illegal immigrant. After 2 months in prison, he was offered a deal: stay in jail and risk deportation, or enlist in the British Army and get Palestinian citizenship. My grandfather grabbed the offer with both hands, and from 1941 to 1945, served in the British Army in the North African and Italian campaigns. In exchange, he got his papers. In our family, it became a sacred duty to preserve documents. Bank statements, electricity bills, expired student cards, letters from the municipality. If it had an official-looking stamp on it, it would be filed in one of the many folders in our cupboard. You never know which of these documents might one day save your life. The Miracle Document. Should we love the bureaucratic information network or hate it? Stories like that of my grandfather indicate the dangers inherent in bureaucratic power. Stories like that of the London cholera epidemic indicate its potential benevolence. All powerful information networks can do both good and ill, depending on how they are designed and used. Merely increasing the quantity of information in the network doesn't guarantee its benevolence or make it any easier to find the right balance between truth and order. That is a key historical lesson for the designers and users of the new information networks of the 21st century. Future information networks, particularly those based on AI, will be different from previous networks in many ways. While in part one, we are examining how mythology and bureaucracy have been essential for large-scale information networks, in part two, we will see how AI is taking up the role of both bureaucrats and mythmakers. AI systems know how to find and process data better than flesh-and-blood bureaucrats, and AI is also acquiring the ability to compose stories better than most humans. But before we explore the new AI-based information networks of the 21st century, and before we examine the threats and promises of AI mythmakers and AI bureaucrats, there is one more thing we need to understand about the long-term history of information networks. We have now seen that information networks don't maximize truth, but rather seek to find a balance between truth and order. Bureaucracy and mythology are both essential for maintaining order, and both are happy to sacrifice truth for the sake of order. What mechanisms, then, ensure that bureaucracy and mythology don't lose touch with truth altogether? And what mechanisms enable information networks to identify and correct their own mistakes, even at the price of some disorder? The way human information networks have dealt with the problem of errors will be the main subject of the next two chapters. We'll start by considering the invention of another information technology, the Holy Book. Holy books like the Bible and the Quran are an information technology that is meant to both include all the vital information society needs and be free from all possibility of error. What happens when an information network believes itself to be utterly incapable of any error? The history of allegedly infallible holy books highlights some of the limitations of all information networks and holds important lessons for the attempt to create infallible AIs in the 21st century. Chapter 4. Errors. The Fantasy of Infallibility. As Saint Augustine famously said, "To err is human. To persist in error is diabolical." The fallibility of human beings and the need to correct human errors have played key roles in every mythology. According to Christian mythology, the whole of history is an attempt to correct Adam and Eve's original sin. According to Marxist-Leninist thinking, even the working class is likely to be fooled by its oppressors and misidentify its own interests, which is why it requires the leadership of a wise party vanguard. Bureaucracy, too, is constantly on the lookout for errors, from misplaced documents to inefficient procedures. Complex bureaucratic systems usually contain self-disciplinary bodies, and when a major catastrophe occurs, like a military defeat or a financial meltdown, commissions of inquiry are set up to understand what went wrong and make sure that the mistake is not repeated. In order to function, self-correcting mechanisms need legitimacy. If humans are prone to error, how can we trust the self-correcting mechanisms to be free from error? To escape this seemingly endless loop, humans have often fantasized about some superhuman mechanism, free from all error, that they can rely upon to identify and correct their own mistakes. Today, one might hope that AI could provide such a mechanism, as when in April 2023, Elon Musk announced, "I am going to start something, which I call Truth GPT, or a maximum truth-seeking AI that tries to understand the nature of the universe." We will see in later chapters why this is a dangerous fantasy. In previous eras, such fantasies took a different form. Religion. In our personal lives, religion can fulfill many different functions, like providing solace or explaining the mysteries of life. But historically, the most important function of religion has been to provide superhuman legitimacy for the social order. Religions like Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism propose that their ideas and rules were established by an infallible superhuman authority and are therefore free from all possibility of error and should never be questioned or changed by fallible humans. Taking humans out of the loop. At the heart of every religion lies the fantasy of connecting to a superhuman and infallible intelligence. This is why, as we shall explore in Chapter 8, studying the history of religion is highly relevant to present-day debates about AI. In the history of religion, a recurrent problem is how to convince people that a certain dogma indeed originated from an infallible superhuman source. Even if, in principle, I am eager to submit to the gods' will, how do I know what the gods really want? Throughout history, many humans have claimed to convey messages from the gods, but the messages often contradict one another. One person said a god appeared to her in a dream. Another person said she was visited by an angel. A third recounted how he met a spirit in the forest, and each preached a different message. The anthropologist Harvey Whitehouse recounts how when he was doing fieldwork among the Bining people of New Britain in the late 1980s, a young man called Tanotka fell sick, and in his feverish delirium began making cryptic statements like, "I am Wutka," and "I am a post." Most of these statements were heard only by Tanotka's older brother, Baninge, who began telling about them to other people and interpreting them in a creative way. Baninge said that his brother was possessed by an ancestral spirit called Wutka, and that he was divinely chosen to be the main support of the community, just as local houses were supported by a central post. After Tanotka recovered, he continued to deliver cryptic messages from Wutka, which were interpreted by Baninge in ever more elaborate ways. Baninge also began having dreams of his own, which allegedly revealed additional divine messages. He claimed that the end of the world was imminent and convinced many of the locals to grant him dictatorial powers so that he could prepare the community for the coming apocalypse. Baninge proceeded to waste almost all the community's resources on extravagant feasts and rituals. When the apocalypse didn't materialize and the community almost starved, Baninge's power collapsed. Though some locals continued to believe that he and Tanotka were divine messengers, many others concluded that the two were charlatans, or perhaps the servants of the devil. How could people distinguish the true will of the gods from the inventions or imaginations of fallible humans? Unless you had a personal divine revelation, knowing what the gods said meant trusting what fallible humans like Tanotka and Baninge claimed the gods said. But how could you trust these humans, especially if you didn't know them personally? Religion wanted to take fallible humans out of the loop and give people access to infallible superhuman laws. But religion repeatedly boiled down to trusting this or that human. One way around this problem was to create religious institutions that vetted the purported divine messengers. Already in tribal societies, communication with superhuman entities like tribal spirits was often the domain of religious experts. Among the Bining people, specialized spirit mediums known as Agungaraga were traditionally responsible for communicating with the spirits and thereby learning the hidden causes of misfortunes ranging from illness to crop failure. Their membership in an established institution made the Agungaraga more trustworthy than Tanotka and Baninge, and made their authority more stable and widely acknowledged. Among the Kalapalo tribe of Brazil, religious rituals were organized by hereditary ritual officers known as the Anetao. In ancient Celtic and Hindu societies, similar duties were the preserve of druids and Brahmins. As human societies grew and became more complex, so did their religious institutions. Priests and oracles had to train long and hard for the important task of representing the gods, so people no longer needed to trust just any lay person who claimed to have met an angel or to carry a divine message. In ancient Greece, for example, if you wanted to know what the god said, you went to an accredited expert like the Pythia, the high priestess at the Temple of Apollo in Delphi. But as long as religious institutions like oracular temples were staffed by fallible humans, they too were open to error and corruption. Herodotus recounts that when Athens was ruled by the tyrant Hippias, the pro-democracy faction bribed the Pythia to help them. Whenever any Spartan came to the Pythia to consult the gods on either official or private matters, the Pythia invariably replied that the Spartans must first free Athens from the tyrant. The Spartans, who were Hippias's allies, eventually submitted to the alleged will of the gods and sent an army to Athens that deposed Hippias in 510 BCE, leading to the establishment of Athenian democracy. If a human prophet could falsify the words of a god, then the key problem of religion wasn't solved by creating religious institutions like temples and priestly orders. People still needed to trust fallible humans in order to access the supposedly infallible gods. Was it possible to somehow bypass the humans altogether?
The infallible technology. Holy books, like the Bible and the Quran, are a technology to bypass human fallibility. And religions of the book, like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, have been built around that technological artifact. To appreciate how this technology is meant to work, we should begin by explaining what a book is and what makes books different from other kinds of written texts. A book is a fixed block of texts, such as chapters, stories, recipes, or epistles, that always go together and have many identical copies. This makes a book something different from oral tales, from bureaucratic documents, and from archives. When telling a story orally, we might tell it a little differently each time, and if many people tell the story over a long time, significant variations are bound to creep in. In contrast, all copies of a book are supposed to be identical. As for bureaucratic documents, they tend to be relatively short and often exist only as a single copy in one archive. If a long document has many copies placed in numerous archives, we would normally call it a book. Finally, a book that contains many texts is also different from an archive, because each archive contains a different collection of texts, whereas all copies of a book contain the same chapters, the same stories, or the same recipes. The book thereby ensures that many people in many times and places can access the same database. The book became an important religious technology in the first millennium BCE. After tens of thousands of years in which gods spoke to humans via shamans, priests, prophets, oracles, and other human messengers, religious movements like Judaism began arguing that the gods speak through this novel technology of the book. There is one specific book whose many chapters allegedly contain all the divine words about everything from the creation of the universe to food regulations. Crucially, no priest, prophet, or human institution can forget or change these divine words, because you can always compare what the fallible humans are telling you with what the infallible book records. But religions of the book have their own set of problems. Most obviously, who decides what to include in the holy book? The first copy didn't come down from heaven. It had to be compiled by humans. Still, the faithful hoped that this thorny problem could be solved by a once-and-for-all supreme effort. If we could get together the wisest and most trustworthy humans, and they could all agree on the contents of the holy book, from that moment onward, we could excise humans from the loop, and the divine words would forever be safe from human interference. Many objections can be raised against this procedure. Who selects the wisest humans? On the basis of what criteria? What if they cannot reach a consensus? What if they later change their minds? Nevertheless, this was the procedure used to compile holy books like the Hebrew Bible. The making of the Hebrew Bible. During the first millennium BCE, Jewish prophets, priests, and scholars produced an extensive collection of stories, documents, prophecies, poems, prayers, and chronicles. The Bible, as a single holy book, didn't exist in biblical times. King David and the prophet Isaiah never saw a copy of the Bible. It is sometimes claimed, erroneously, that the oldest surviving copy of the Bible comes from the Dead Sea Scrolls. These scrolls are a collection of about 900 different documents, written mostly in the last 2 centuries BCE and found in various caves around Qumran, a village near the Dead Sea. Most scholars believe they constituted the archive of a Jewish sect that lived nearby. Significantly, none of the scrolls contains a copy of the Bible, and no scroll indicates that the 24 books of the Old Testament were considered a single and complete database. Some of the scrolls certainly record texts that are today part of the